You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. I'm Art Ray. Today we'll be going to the archives to hear a presentation by Thomas Sugrue. Thomas Joseph Sugrue lived from 1907 to 1953. He was an outstanding writer, authoring 7 exceptional books and hundreds of articles. He sought the help of psychic Edgar Cayce for a rare arthritis disease for which conventional treatments were not working. He arrived at the Cayce's home in June of 1939 as a dying person with a few weeks to live. With Hugh Lynn Cayce as his nurse, he received readings from Edgar Cayce and treatment for his condition. He entered Cayce's home an invalid and left walking in October of 1941. It was during this time that he wrote There Is a River, the only biography of Edgar Cayce written during Cayce's lifetime, and the book that made the psychic a household name in 1942. Still available, his biography of Cayce's life has touched the hearts of hundreds of thousands. He also lent his writing talents to the Edgar Cayce Association for Research and Enlightenment for numerous articles and news items.
In about 50 years, your children will be able to say either the prophecy is true or it's not true. The reason that Mr. Cayce and I are going to speak to you about what we call the great prophecies is that these great prophecies are existing, some of them for 1,000 years or more, some of them for perhaps several thousand years. It seems that if they are going to come true at all, 60 years, so that we can wipe them off the books one way or the other. Either they will be fulfilled or they will be proved to have been hallucinations or fraudulent devices of some over-imaginative prophet or astrologer or saint. And nowadays, I think above all times in the world, people would like to know what is going to happen. And they are worried about it, and they are also of the opinion, I think all of you realize now when you read the papers, that anything can happen, which makes it right for some of the great prophecies to come true. I was reading this afternoon on the plane coming over from Chicago in Life magazine that the Army is now of the opinion, as are scientists in general, that the flying saucers may well be coming into our atmosphere from outer space, from other planets. And last week I read in another magazine that we are actually planning and have nothing really to stop us except the money to go out into space and anchor an artificial satellite out there which will go around the world every 2 hours. And where we will have an observation post from which we will watch and police the world. These things have become extremely casual now. We got trained into them after about 15 years of Buck Rogers and the other spaceship boys and the comics. And the idea that anything can happen is expressed by one of the current jokes in the New State of Israel. They're having a very hard time over there economically because they have to bring in a lot of refugees, and refugees cost money. They have to be housed and clothed and fed and integrated into the economy of the nation. And if we took into the United States as many as they have taken in the 3 years they've been having a state, we would now have, instead of 150 million people, 300 million. Well, this worries Prime Minister Ben-Gurion and the members of his cabinet a great deal. And one day recently, one of the cabinet members came to Ben-Gurion and said, David, I have a wonderful idea which will solve all our problems. Ben-Gurion said, what is it? And the cabinet member said, let us declare war on the United States. Then, after we have been defeated, which should not take very long, they will occupy our country and solve all our problems. And Ben-Gurion thought for a while, and then he said, that's a wonderful idea. But with our luck, we'd probably win. Now, what is prophecy? You and I live in it all the time, but we don't realize it. Every man and every woman, you people here, as well as myself, we live in a state whereby we are continuously committing our free will to acts which will take place in the future. All of you, I suppose, will go to work somewhere tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. Well, according to the free will that you have given you by your Creator, you don't have to stay there. You can walk out at 9:30 and go wherever you like, get on a train or a plane, or spend the day sitting in the park. But you won't do that, because you have committed yourself to that job, and you've committed yourself to certain other responsibilities in life, so that the pattern of your life is, in a sense, predictable. Also, you make dates, you make even social dates, and there is a predictable pattern there. But all of this is predicated upon your ideas of what you want to accomplish with the energy which is in your body and the intelligence which is in your mind and the pattern of morality which is in your heart. You have a free will, but you use it, you harness it, you discipline it to the things that you consider worthwhile in life. And so any man and any woman at any time has a certain part of his life which is predictable, a certain predictable future. And after all, we can't work on anything else. No matter how hard you figure it out, every act that you commit is tended toward conditioning the future to make it better for yourself. Now, that goes on for everything. It goes on for society, goes on for crops. We call it, in a sense, planning. And the life insurance companies have now made such a skill of it that if they tell you that there are 400 children going to be graduated from high school in your town, they can tell you how many of them will live to be such and such an age, how many will marry, how many children they'll have, how much money the average will make, how many will go to college, how many will die at 45, and so on. They say that that is on the theory of probability. That taking this group as being members of our American society, and therefore, in general, committed to the goals of this society. That knowing that the only jobs and careers open to them are available for information, that they can predict just about what will happen. But they can't predict what will happen to any one individual. In other words, they can say that out of the 400, let's say, 35 will be dead at the age of 45. They can say that, and it will be true. There will be 35 dead at 45, but they cannot predict which individuals. And that leaves free will within the theory of probability. Now, in Washington, in the Department of Agriculture, there's a man named Louis Dean, who works at the prediction of crops. And he does it so accurately that the newspaper men in Washington have called him the greatest prophet since Daniel. And he says that it is possible to get all of the influences which are going to affect the crops in this country together. And the only thing which prevents making a completely accurate prediction about our crops is the fact that it would take all the brains in the world and all the men all their lifetimes to figure out on calculating machines all of these pieces of evidence. So that in order to save time, it's necessary to choose certain indicative pieces. And this is done by one man, and it's done so accurately that the farmers and the other people in the country and those who buy the food can pretty well rely on it. Well, looking backward at history, which you read in school, in terms of the historian's point of view, you read often that at such and such a point, a society took a turn for this or took a turn for that, or its moral pattern began to slip, or its rulers took on a certain aggressive pattern. And the historian says that at that time, either the rise of the society or the decline of the society began and was, in a sense, predictable. Now, those who were living contemporaneously at the time that the Roman Empire fell, or Greece rose, or Charlemagne became king, or the Middle Ages began, didn't know that they were participating in this rise or fall or movement. Those who lived in the Middle Ages didn't know they were living in the Middle Ages. They didn't go around saying, isn't it fun to live in the Middle Ages? They had They lived in the present. No man who lived in the Renaissance knew he was a Renaissance man. He just thought he was living in a rather exciting time, similar to ours, when a great many new discoveries were being made. So, we must consider this, that the historian has figured out that when certain conditions took place in those societies, from that moment on, the future unfolded according to a certain plan, which is just as predictable as the plan which will unfold for your son, say, if he enters college, and you know that on the theory of probability, he'll get through in 4 years if accidents don't intervene. So why can't we, therefore, if we have the intelligence and we have the time to devote to figuring the trends, be able to take the pattern of our society?
We'll be right back with more with Thomas Sugrue. You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. We're back with Thomas Sugrue.
Take the pattern of our society, what we want, what we're trying to do, what we're beginning to commit ourselves to, and predict our own future. We could do this. And it is possible, for example, to see where skillful men working in their own peculiar specialties have been able to do this. Scientists have been able to predict that in a certain number of years, such and such and so and so will be found, and they are found. Henry Adams, who was an historian, wrote a letter, I think, in the year 1900, in which he accurately predicted that we would be at war with Russia on the Chinese coast around Korea, and he even gave the year 1950. Now, Adams wasn't a prophet, but Adams had studied history to the point where he knew what the societies of Europe and the United States were committed to. A former president of the University of Virginia named Edwin Alderman wrote a letter in September of 1914, when the World War had first broken out in Europe, in which he said, speaking of those who were embroiled in the war, he said, by 1950, all of these nations and our own will be at war with Russia. These men were not prophets. They were people like the man in Washington. They might be called prophets, but they were making deductions from knowledge which already they possessed. Now, the prophet, on the other hand, is a man who, instead of sitting down to do any figuring or any deducing, is so identified in his own mind with a moral point of view that he, at times, sees visions, sees the future far off, and he sees the crises of his own people in terms of the obstacles that they are going to encounter as they continue in the path. But the path that they are following, from his point of view, is one which is not particularly bothered with by men who are interested either in history or in agriculture or in science. Human beings are born into the world, and man himself came in as a race with an anchor in the flesh. We circle around a certain specific gravity. We are creative at the level of the flesh. We can reproduce ourselves. God has given us all we have earned through evolution, the ability to bring forth, as do the animals, into the world, pictures and patterns and reproductions of ourselves. Our destiny in the world and our dreams and all of our aspirations are centered upon learning to be creative at higher levels than that of the flesh, and at the higher levels at which we see and understand, sometimes instinctively, sometimes intellectually, that God himself is creative. We try to be creative through raising this reproductive force up to the level of what we call brotherly love. We try to be creative in terms of art. We try to be creative in terms of sociology, in terms of community. We try to be creative on the level of the mind, on the level of the emotions, and in the level of the spirit. And these are the aspirations that we have, and all of religion from time immemorial has centered its effort on assisting and encouraging and stimulating man to make that effort to be creative on a higher level, to raise up what the Hindu calls the sacred fire of life, which dwells within him. And all of the symbology of religion, East and West, has the ladder. It has the rope with the seven knots in it. It has all of the patterns that go upward, onward and upward, until, as you all know, the saint is represented with a halo. And the halo around his head represents that he has lifted his own sacred fire of life given to him by God to the level where he creates, as God creates, up in the spiritual field. Now that simply sets before you the pattern on which the prophet is working. The man in Washington is interested in the outcome of our crops. The prophet wants to know and is interested in and is worried about this great vacillation, this great flame of life, which in society is sliding up and down the rope, which seems at times to be on only the physical level, when instead of going upward through charity and brotherly love, it slips down and creates wars, rumors of wars and quarrels. And when instead of having cooperative communities where we assist one another, it develops into a kind of class warfare, or into fascism, or into communism. So the prophet from Jeremiah and Isaiah and all the other great prophets of the Bible, on downward into modern times, has always spoken in terms of this effort of man to be creative at a higher level, and he's always spoken in terms more or less of the life insurance companies. He looks ahead and sees that if certain trends keep going that way, then at a certain time, Jerusalem will be destroyed, the Jews will be exiled, and Western man will get into this kind of a mess, and there will be this great battle and that great battle. But he always looks and predicts towards something which he sees as the end. And the end, in his estimation, is not total destruction. The end is a great struggle in which a lot of destruction takes place, but out of which man emerges from the age of what we call faith, when he believes in God through faith, to the age of certainty, when he believes in God because he knows he exists. One of the prophets describes it as a time when it will no longer be necessary to teach children of the knowledge of God, because they will be born with this knowledge in their heart. Now this is the great age of millennium, a great age of peace that we have heard about all our lives. Mystically speaking, we know that it's possible to achieve it individually. But we also know that there are two things in which you and I participate. One is our individual effort to reach the creative level where we touch the hand of God. And the other one is the movement of our entire society in that same direction. And we know that we are caught and that we must participate in the great effort of our society and at the same time take our own individual path. And great prophets and true prophets are men who identify their point of view with this effort of their society, and who always speak in terms of their society's future and their society's peril. And they always speak in great, long, drawn-out terms which apparently have to do with the entire stretch of humanity's effort. I'll give you an example of what I mean by this kind of prophetic utterance. And because we're so close here to the spot on which it was uttered, I will give that one first before any of the older prophets. Over in the neighboring state of Illinois, in a town called Nauvoo, about 110 years ago, there was a colony of what later came to be called Mormons, but which were then called Latter-day Saints, under the leadership of their prophet, Joseph Smith. A lot of stories have been told about Joseph Smith, and he, in a sense, has become, as one does in the United States, the object of both reverence and ridicule. But there isn't any doubt, leaving aside anything to do with his theology or his church, that he was a natural mystic and a natural clairvoyant and a natural prophet. That he did. There were more examples than one could laugh or explain away as to his real skill or his natural genius. One, for example, was over here in Norville, Illinois. He and some friends went one day to the installation of the officers of a Masonic lodge, and they were standing outside in the warm day, and one of them brought Smith a glass of water taken from a well, right there, dug right there by the side of the building. And he sampled the water and turned and said, "Brother, this water tastes much like that which flows in the Rocky Mountains, where the saints will go following another great period of persecution, and where they will become a mighty people." And then he began to look around and point out among those who were gathered, those who would go and those who would not go, because they would not be still then alive. Now, at that time, the Latter-day Saints were very happy and content in Norville, Illinois. They didn't intend to go any farther. Eventually, they did, under Brigham Young. They did go out. They did go to the Rockies. And at the time that this was spoken, that Smith said this, the Rocky Mountains were not even in the United States. In fact, they weren't in the United States when the Mormons first went there. Now, there was an example of what we call clairvoyance combined with prophecy. Smith apparently had no idea that he was going to say anything of the sort. He drank the water. The water, the taste of the water, brought to him a clairvoyant vision of the Rocky Mountains, which in turn showed him something that was going to happen in the future to his people, something to which they were already committed, because according to their own free will, they weren't going to accept the domination of any other people, and they were going to practice the religion of their choice, which meant that they were going to have to keep moving. And this, in a sense, was already effective in time. It just hadn't come up to the present. Now, not long after this particular utterance, Smith spent an afternoon listening to an old fellow named James Taylor, who had fought under Wellington at the Battle of Waterloo. And the old fellow was telling him about the terrible battle, as old soldiers do, and how the blood flowed and people were being shot and how fortunate he was to escape. And finally, Smith said, "Father Taylor, you will live, though I will not, to see greater battles than that of Waterloo. The United States will go to war with Mexico and will gain thereby a large piece of territory. There will be a great war between the North and the South over the question of Negro slaves. And in this battle, there will be more bloody encounters than that of Waterloo. But," and this is the part in which he joins with the great prophets and takes a look into the far future. "But," he said, "when the great bear lays her paw on the lion, the winding up scene is not far off."
We'll be right back with more. You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. We're back with Thomas Sugrue.
Now, the great bear is always Russia. The lion is always England. And the great bear's paw around Iran and Iraq and those oil wells in the Middle East in the present is not very far from the lion. That kind, of course, you know that prediction done early in the 1840s contained three prophecies, all of which were fulfilled. Smith's own death took place within a few years before the 1846 war with Mexico. The war with Mexico did take place. The war between the North and the South did take place. Now, the fourth part of the prophecy might happen, and you might read it in the paper tomorrow. It might be a brush. Russia, if she, for example, we almost expect that if she decides to go through with that truce in Korea, she might start a push in the Middle East. And we also are, I think, adapted to the idea that if we have a Third World War, that really is the winding up scene. By the time we get through with that, then that time will come when we will realize we cannot make war anymore, as the Bible says, that we must live in peace. And also, there is roaring away, like a fire engine, the modern advance in science, which has now brought us to the point where we have discovered through nuclear physics and chemistry and all our other sciences that materialism and the world itself are made up not of anything solid, not of any building blocks, but just of electricity, electrons as we call them, and that these form themselves into certain atoms which become different according to the number of electrons that circle around the nucleus, and that these different types of atoms mix themselves in different kinds of molecules, and these different kinds of molecules mix themselves in other different patterns under, apparently, the direction of some mind, some great mind. And so we end up, as now our scientists say, we apparently have a universe made up of a kind of force which we can only call that of the spirit. We don't know what electricity is. And that it operates under, apparently, some kind of a mind. So that people like Eddington and Jeans have said we have got now to accept the fact that we live in a mental universe, one of the minds. So, with these things facing us, and knowing that the mind is the instrument by which we build our way up to that higher level of creativity, and seeing by the use of our mind that we are beginning more and more to imitate creation on the higher levels, we might expect that during this period we would encounter a crisis, and the crisis would be, what are we going to do with this ability now to create on a higher level? Are we going to use it to emancipate ourselves, make the world a better place in which to live so that each of us individually can follow his own destiny, or are we going to try to use it to make ourselves just richer and give ourselves more pleasure, to deny these to the rest of the world, the result of which obviously will be a third world war and a great deal, almost perhaps a total destruction. So I began to look at these great prophecies to see whether there was an indication that they were tied up with this modern era. And either they are very closely tied up, and this is the time of Advent, as it were, or a time of the end of one kind of thinking and the beginning of a new kind of thinking, or, as I said, in 50 years you can forget prophecy. Now, the great prophecies have to be anchored at some point in time. So let's take the first one, the first great prophecy, which very obviously has been fulfilled. I don't know how well acquainted you are with the prophecies in the Old Testament which predict that God will gather together the remnant of his people and return them to the land of Israel. Well, the Jews have been returned to the land of Israel. They have been taken back to Palestine. And they have been returned in a manner which, as I have been there, spent 6 months there when the state was being born, are so truly parallel to the manner in which it is described, that there isn't any doubt but what here is a prophecy which has been fulfilled. Even to the tiniest details, there is one point in one of the prophecies where the Lord, speaking through his prophet, says, I will draw a third part through the fire and try them as I try silver and as I try gold. And they will look up and call out to me and say that I am their God. And I will look down and say that they are my people. Well, there were 18 million Jews in the world when the Second World War began, and Hitler killed 6 million of them through the fires of his concentration camp. So the prophecy that he would gather together his people has been fulfilled, and that in the Bible, you'll read the prophecies, is always followed then by the great battle which comes when the armies of the north, and that's exactly where Russian armies would come from, the armies of Gog and Magog descend upon what are called the unwalled cities of Israel. And we might have a war there any time now, and it's possible that the Russian armies might be involved in it. So that having established one part of this prophecy, we see the other one predicted, and following that, this great period of peace, when the armies of the world will beat their swords into plowshares. They will, as the Bible says, study war no more. And the children will not have to be taught of the knowledge of God. They will be born with it in their hearts. Now, you know that if we do survive this great scientific age and this third world war, that we undoubtedly are going to come into a period of great blessedness in the world, where we have the genius and the wisdom and the knowledge to live together cooperatively and helpfully and use the scientific discoveries that we make in a peaceful way, we shall certainly come in the 21st century to a time of the millennium. And you might find any time in the next 30 or 40 years a headline staring you from the paper in the morning saying that General Electric or somebody else, after 5 years of secret laboratory experiments, is convinced that a certain radio wave that they have been dickering with is bringing in messages from the dead, and so that scientific proof of life after death has been established. Well, you've been going along, and I've been going along, we've all been going along, believing in life after death for thousands of years. But it so happens that in our time, the frame of reference which is absolute and which we believe is science. You see a story in the morning that a certain vitamin pill will do something for you in a certain way. You do not question it, do you? You just go down and buy it. Well, in the Middle Ages, when a man went along the roads and had a bag and took out a bone and said, this is a bone from the body of one of the apostles, nobody questioned him either. Because in that time, that was the frame of reference which people believed. Now it is science. So we can take one great prophecy, which, once it's fulfilled, seems to indicate that two others will come soon. Now look at another great prophecy, which also might give us, possibly, a date. There is a prophecy called that of St. Malachy, who was an Irishman, lived in the 12th century, and at that time Ireland, the Church of Ireland, was not under Rome. And there was a lot of trouble over there because certain freebooting feudal barons stole the bishoprics and bought them and ruled over them. And Malachy, who from his childhood was a natural mystic, natural clairvoyant, had visions, had healing experiences, got the bishops, that is the really religious bishops, to agree to give him the power to go to Rome and offer the Church of Ireland to the Pope, who was then named Celestine II. On the way, he stopped in France at Clairvaux, where St. Bernard lived. There again, you see, they didn't call him St. Bernard then. You have to die first. You don't know you're a saint until a long time afterward. Now, while he was there, you see, Bernard was a tremendous influence in Europe, and he didn't hesitate, hadn't hesitated, to scold the popes on various occasions because the popes weren't such good men then. And so I suppose he and Malachy talked about the papacy and its future and whether it was a good thing to have it and whether they ought to get rid of it and so on. At any rate, as a result, St. Malachy got a vision and wrote a great prophecy in which he described in Latin phrases all the popes thereafter that were going to reign in Rome. And he gave it to the Pope as a gift. Now, this wasn't published until the early part of the 16th century. And at that time, all of his descriptions, all his little phrases of the popes were so accurate that it looked as if it were fraudulent. So let's, in our figuring, just drop all those popes and say, all right, you can't figure, because somebody might have written it then under the name of St. Malachy. So that you have to look at the next 111 popes from the 16th century on, and each little phrase describes either the coat of arms of the pope's family or the town from which he came, or the work his father did, or something which is very easily identifiable, except in certain cases where the historical events which took place in the time of that pope's reign were of such greatness and importance that the phrase described that. For example, I think the pope who had trouble with Napoleon.
We'll be right back with more. You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. We're back with Thomas Sugrue.
You remember that Napoleon wanted it, made him crown him, and then snatched the crown out of his own hand, or out of the Pope's hands. He was described as the Pope of the Black Eagle. Now, the Black Eagle was the Napoleon's sign and the one that was on the banner of his army. Now, the interesting thing about this prophecy is that it is not only either very coincidental or very accurate in the description of the popes, but the main fact is that there are only five more popes in the prophecy. And that the popes of the last 200 or 300 years have averaged, again we get this average, they've averaged about 12 years. So multiply 5 by 12 and you've got about 60 years, let's say, at a maximum. for the papacy. Now, that doesn't end up by saying that the church itself is destroyed or rejected or anything of the sort, but the last little description that St. Malachy gives is, in the final persecution of the Church of Rome, Peter the Roman shall sit, or will sit, in the chair of the Vicar of Christ, and the seven hill city of Rome will be destroyed. And then, apparently there is nothing more, but you can see that that could easily take place. The trouble we're already having in Europe. If the armies of the East, if the Russian armies decided at the end of this century to really roll and did go down through Italy and destroy Rome or bomb it away, and it's quite possible that if we did have a tremendous war at that time, toward the end of this century, that there would be so few cardinals left because all those in Europe would be swallowed up. And the difficulty of getting together and the burden of the war we were in might postpone their getting together until the war was over, and history shows us that under such circumstances, very often one goes on postponing and postponing, and then with democracy, practically the only kind of society existent in the world, because all the prophecies at least give you the comfort that our side's going to win, it's possible that they may go on in a kind of democratic college of cardinals. At any rate, that is one of the great prophecies, and putting that alongside the fact that the Jews have been returned to the Holy Land, at least there are two parts which indicate that our period is beginning to see the fulfillment of these. Now, the next man we'll consider is Nostradamus. You've all heard of Nostradamus. Hollywood popularized him during the war. They made two shorts in which many of his great prophecies were demonstrated. He was so accurate in his own lifetime in predicting the illnesses and deaths of kings and all sorts of things that he had become about the most famous of all prophets. He himself said that he purposely disguised his descriptions of the future and made them enigmatic because, he said, and this is the reason, because they're so awful. And they cannot be changed. They cannot be changed because when 2 billion souls are operating in the world, you have a theory of probability that no matter how much free will is operative, they are all going to go through certain tests. And so there will be times when society, stumbling in the dark, trying to find its own destiny, will have these catastrophic happenings. Nostradamus predicts great troubles from 1953 on, through about 1958. But he doesn't, and then, as with some of the others I've examined of a minor nature, there seems to be a tremendous period of 35 or 40 years when apparently our scientific materialism is going to come to its fullest peak of blossom. But then in 1999, Nostradamus has, for a prediction, there's going to be an eclipse of the moon, there's going to be an eclipse of the sun. Now that's no longer a prophecy, because any astronomer has in his book that these two things are going to take place. The interesting thing is that in the 16th century, that Nostradamus accurately predicted these two things, and that the first book containing these calculations didn't come out until a few centuries later. He did them on his own. But he dated around these two eclipses great changes in the whole world society. Wars, strife, struggles, but also shifting in the world's land surface, great tidal waves, sinking of pieces of land, rising of other pieces of land. There is, if you may have heard also some of you, a certain dated prophecy that apparently lies within the Great Pyramid of Egypt. I mention that because after spending months and months on that, I can only tell you that it has either importance attached to the biblical prophecies or none whatsoever, because the dates are arbitrary. People began to measure the inner chambers of the Great Pyramid, and they have found that by taking 1 inch and calling it a year, that the ascending passages and the pattern of the inner structure of the pyramid seems to be laid out to follow the great development of the Jewish history in the that is beginning with the Exodus.
Well, it's time for the Thought for the Day. And today's Thought for the Day will be read by Allison Ray, my wife. Well, hello.
Hi, how are you today?
Oh, good. And what's today's thought for the day?
Today's thought for the day is 1792-2. Hence, again, might that injunction be given the entity not to be too easily discouraged. Brace up, knowing what ye have believed and do believe, but know who is also the author of such. For life is real, life is earnest, and the grave is not the goal.
Wow. Well, what does that mean to you?
In this, he's reminding us, Mr. Casey's reminding us, that sometimes we're going to have challenges and we shouldn't just give up and walk away from it, that sometimes we have to, you know, stand up for ourselves and maybe do the things we don't necessarily think we want to do.
Oh, yes.
And I know that for me, sometimes if a challenge comes, I think, oh, well, the universe is just trying to tell me that I shouldn't be doing that. And sometimes I need somebody to remind me, well, sometimes you just have to face your trials and overcome them.
And yes, this says to not be too easily discouraged and to brace up. And I guess we just have to accept that we're going to see these obstacles and have to overcome them, and that we do that through belief.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And knowing what you believe in and why you believe what you believe.
Yes. Well, thank you for doing the thought for the day today.
Thank you. And individuals can actually go to edgarcasey.org and sign up to have the thought for the day delivered right to their mailbox by email.
That's all the time we have for the show today. Thanks for listening to the presentation by Thomas Sugrue. To find out more, go to edgarcasey.org. Thanks also to Allison Ray for the thought for the day, and most of all to you, the listener. Thanks for listening to Reflections, the wisdom of Edgar Casey.